You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to this episode of the Daily Vet Life podcast, where we chat with equine veterinarians about the cases they've worked on in their clinics. I'm your host, Alex Beckstedt, editorial director of Equimanagement. And today I'm speaking with Dr. Phoebe Smith about an endocrine case that she worked on recently. This episode of the Daily Vet Life podcast is brought to you by DECRA. Dr. Smith owns Riviera Equine Internal Medicine and Consulting in Santa Ynez, California. Upon receiving her veterinary degree from Auburn University in 1997, Dr. Smith completed an internship at Alamo Pintado Equine Medical Center in Los Olivos. Following 2 years in private practice, she completed an internal medicine residency at the University of California, Davis, while concurrently working as a relief veterinarian with Loomis Basin Large Animal Clinic. After achieving board certification with the American College of Veterinary Internal Medicine in 2003, Dr. Smith rejoined Alamo Pintado as an internal medicine specialist. In 2007, she joined the faculty at The Ohio State University as an assistant professor of equine internal medicine until establishing her current practice in 2010. Thank you, Dr. Smith, for joining us today.
My pleasure to be here.
Well, let's jump right in with this case. I'm excited to hear what you're going to share with us today. Can you just get started by telling us about the patient and how it first presented to you?
Certainly, happy to. So the case that I wanted to share today is an atypical endocrine case. And as we learn more and more about endocrine cases, we may find they're more typical than we think. But I think all of us do see PPID pretty regularly. And so I wanted to share one that's a little bit more complex than the average straightforward endocrine case. So the patient that we're going to talk about today was referred to me by a colleague who had some unusual blood work and clinical presentation. He had been managing the horse for a short period of time, a number of weeks to a few months, but the horse came to him with a history of recurrent laminitis for about 10 years prior to coming to the referring veterinarian. And so the primary care veterinarian, my colleague, was doing a really nice job managing his feet with corrective farriery. But the problem that he called me with initially was, I've got this skinny horse. Clearly he's PPID. The original veterinarian had diagnosed that, and the horse was on an FDA-approved pergolide. The horse is skinny, has a normal ACTH, a persistently elevated insulin, and is on a reasonably low sugar diet, was not on a diet that really should have made this horse have a high insulin. And certainly in California, we don't see a whole lot of green grass, and the time of year that we initially saw this horse was not on green grass. And so that was sort of the conundrum. Why do I have this skinny horse on an appropriate diet with his insulin that I can't get to budge? And so the first thing that I want to look at in this horse, a couple of things. And one is the comfort level of the horse. Is severe pain affecting some of our endocrine indices, insulin in particular? And the horse was not severely painful. It was actually being managed super well, a little bit of NSAIDs, either Equiox or Bute. And I will say the other piece of the history was about 3 weeks into every shoeing cycle, the horse would get sore. So he'd do well for the first 3 weeks. And then he was on sort of a 6 week shoeing cycle. And right about 3 weeks in, he'd start getting sore again. That was sort of a little bit of a tip off that there was something cyclical happening. So again, the horse was not exquisitely painful. And so initially we did a telemedicine appointment and I recommended that triglycerides be run. And the reason that I was interested in looking at triglycerides in this horse is we had a skinny horse, a body condition score somewhere, say 4.5 out of 9 using the Haneke body scoring system. But this persistently elevated insulin. So I wanted to know, is this horse mobilizing fat basically to feed himself? Does his body think that he's in a negative energy balance? I've seen that happen a few times. Indeed, this horse who sort of eats all day long, again, a low NSC diet, had a moderately elevated triglyceride count, around 150, say. And so the horse was close enough, I was actually able to examine the horse. A lot of the telemedicine consultations I do, are the horses are too far away, so I don't get to see them myself. In this particular case, the horse was not so far, so I was able to be sort of hands-on as well, which was really nice, and work with this colleague, you know, very directly, hands-on. And he maintained the farriery very well. And I sort of moved into the lead role in the endocrine part of the thing. And so indeed, examining the horse, body condition score, I scored him about a 4. He did have a thick and coarse hair coat and was, you know, maybe very mildly laminitic in terms of the clinical presentation. ACTH, normal, again, very normal. Insulin persistently elevated between 150 and 200 is the cutoff at the lab that we typically would send our insulins to. And so sometimes they'd be greater than 200. And when I do insulin testing, at least my baseline insulin testing, it is usually a hay only, so no concentrates. If the horse eats hay pellets, I'm fine with that, but I'll test insulin hay only. There are other scenarios, well, where I will test insulin in a postprandial test. I really want to know, like, what's the effect of this horse's diet on his insulin? Or I'll do a pasture insulin, but my sort of baseline is hay only. I don't want the horse completely stressing out in a no food, you know, fasted situation. Fasted is fine for insulin. But sometimes, you know, every other horse is getting fed in the barn. This horse is jumping up and down and running around in their stall. And I don't need that potentially affecting any results. So I do hay only. Ideally, they're not feeding a horse we're concerned about an insulin level, any sort of grain hay. So, you know, a forage or an oat hay. But if they're on alfalfa, fine. If they're on grass hay, fine. And so This was a persistent issue with this horse. Again, this horse actually was appropriately eating alfalfa hay and grass hay, but he was sort of a picky fellow, but he ate a fair bit of, he would eat, say, 4 flakes. So, you know, 20 pounds of alfalfa hay per day and some alfalfa pellets, and then a smattering of sort of controlled or low starch concentrates and supplements. And so despite, again, appropriate diet, we had this elevated insulin, elevated triglycerides, very normal ACTH. I have to say a clinical phenotypical appearance of incomplete Cushing's control. And many of you will know this appearance that, like, the numbers look good, but the horse, you know, tells a little bit of a different story. And ACTH is really just one marker of Cushing's. It's not the end all be all. There are other things that truthfully might be a little bit more sensitive that aren't commercially available to measure right now. So ACTH is what we have. And so using the clinical appearance and the value, ACTH value, I think is super important, not using one in lieu of the other.
Calling all equine veterinarians. Are you tired of feeling like you're on an island when it comes to caring for your patients? Dechra Veterinary Products is here to bridge that gap. They understand the challenges you face. That's why they offer a comprehensive line of high-quality products like Zycosan and Osphos, and empower you to offer your patients cutting-edge therapies like ProVet APC. They're not just a supplier, though. Dechra provides ongoing training and support to help you stay ahead of the curve and deliver the best possible care. Visit www.dechra-us.com to discover how Dechra can be your partner in equine health.
So we pretty quickly realized that we're not going to get this insulin lowered in this horse any more than we sort of have. He can't exercise because his feet aren't that comfortable. You know, he was allowed to, like, walk in his little paddock, but he couldn't be taken out and exercised. And he was already on a pretty low NSC diet. And we did our calculations and it was, you know, between 10 and 12%. So he really was on an appropriate diet for a hyperinsulinemic animal. And so this is a case that I felt it was appropriate to use an SGLT2 inhibitor. So ertugliflozin, I know it's a mouthful, is the one that I have the most experience with and is probably the most commonly used SGLT2 inhibitor in this country. And so despite his mild, I'm going to say mildly elevated triglycerides, it really seemed the lesser of the evils, if you will, to start an SGLT2 inhibitor to lower his insulin to try to stop this laminitis. I knew that we would have to keep an eye on those triglycerides. We know that horses who have a normal triglyceride level when they start an SGLT2 inhibitor can develop hypertriglyceridemia. And we were already starting a little bit elevated, right? But, you know, talked it all over with the owner and they were keen to go ahead. And as I've seen in nearly all cases at recheck 5 days later, insulin is very normal. So 150 the day we started, it might've been like 157 or something. And 5 days later, it's under 30. You can actually recheck earlier and it will be low. It's pretty darn remarkable. And for anybody who's forgotten how that particular drug works, it inhibits the reuptake of glucose in the urine. So basically they're glucose uric, right? They do become PUPD if you haven't used this drug a lot. And they're glucose uric. I haven't seen any complications from that, but owners should be aware that if they're PPID, they're probably, you know, they may be a little bit, you know, incompletely controlled PP, a little PUPD. And when you add in the SGLT2 inhibitor, you're going to increase that. So they're going to have a soggy paddock unless you do something about it. And so the piece that we really knew that we had to watch was this horse's triglycerides. And he did okay. And by okay, I mean, they increased his triglycerides. And so at the same time that I would recheck his insulin, I'd recheck his triglycerides as well. And his clinical picture. He became significantly more comfortable on his feet within 5 days. And I have to say, I've seen that multiple times as well, just as soon as you get the insulin lowered. And, you know, the exact mechanism, we don't know. There are definitely some working theories about the effect of insulin on the lamellar tissue, but the exact mechanism is not fully known. But nonetheless, clinically, I definitely see that by lowering insulin, a much more comfortable animal. And really, when I step back from analyzing all these numbers and getting excited about how cool they are, I want the horse more comfortable. Right. Everybody wants the horse more comfortable. And so that's sort of the priority. I don't want to damage organ systems or have problems in the meantime. But sometimes I think it's easy to get sort of caught up in like in the numbers and the values. And it's important to step back and say, how's the horse doing? How's everybody feeling about how happy the horse is? Horse was much happier on his feet. However, I will say these owners were great and allowed me to do quite a lot of rechecking of this horse, which really allowed me to develop a pretty clear picture of what's going on with him. So it was after about 3 months on the SGLT2 inhibitor, horse is doing well clinically. He actually got a little bit sore again. We, of course, rechecked his insulin and his insulin is climbing. Triglycerides had sort of leveled out. They did increase and then they sort of leveled out, which is what I see most of the time with this drug. And so insulin was increasing. Oh, that might not be right. Maybe that's a one-off, right? I mean, the endocrine system is so dynamic that a one-time something that doesn't quite fit, I'll often recheck it. Okay, let's recheck in a couple of days. Fine. So we recheck. Yes, indeed. Insulin is back up, you know, 125, 150. So, and the horse was not exquisitely painful. It was a little more painful. And my colleague is saying, yeah, I'm seeing some changes in his feet again. So we really had to sort of think about what to do. The horse had been solidly on the SGLT2 inhibitor for 3 months. And so we sort of talked about some options. We can consider switching to a different drug in the same class. There is some work on canagliflozin, certainly more expensive than the ertugliflozin. We can try dosing twice a day with the ertugliflozin. Owner elected to go that route. It did nothing for the horse's insulin. Okay. So then we just sort of got creative, as one does when one can't figure out what exactly to do next. And we decided to press pause on the ertugliflozin and see what would happen. So the first time I did this, I stopped the drug. And on day five, the horse got painful on his feet again. Immediately started it again. Again, the overarching goal is a comfortable horse. What happened in that time is his insulin did actually fall. So that gets a little bit curious, right? If we know that initially when we give the drug, it's the decline in insulin that makes the horse more comfortable. Why is it in this case that with the rise of insulin, the horse became uncomfortable? I don't know, but it happened. And so we resumed the ertugliflozin. And again, the triglycerides would go up, and sometimes they would go as high as 800, 900. When they got that high triglycerides, as in most horses, I think the threshold varies horse to horse. That's been my experience. Many horses at 800 feel great, fine. They don't care. In triglyceridemia that is induced by an SGLT2 inhibitor, in hypertriglyceridemia from another cause, of which there are many, those animals don't feel well. This looks very different. It's sort of the same idea that was happening in this horse before we even started this drug. The body, the cells think they're in a negative energy balance, right? If they have tissue level insulin insensitivity, those cells aren't getting the glucose because the insulin is going, I can't hear you. I'm not going to put any glucose in the cells. And so the cells are like, fine, I need energy. And the body starts mobilizing fat from the liver. And they truly, I've actually biopsied a couple of these, and they will have fatty liver infiltrates. Like their body thinks they're in a negative energy balance because of this insulin dysregulation. So this horse, what I learned to do is to stop and start. The next time I stopped his ertugliflozin, when our insulin started to climb, I stopped it for 2 days because I got chicken. And 5 days seemed too much. Why not two? This was somewhat arbitrary. Fortunately, the owner was wonderful and sort of trusted me to make best decisions for the horse. And so I think we learned a lot. I certainly learned a ton on this case and was able to sort of balance the triglycerides that would always climb when he's on the medication and the insulin, which would slowly climb on the medication. And we finally were able to sort of come to a schedule that works for this horse of on off. I've worked with a number of other veterinarians on cases, in a consulting fashion, that schedule doesn't work. So I think it's probably a very individual thing, but I just wanted to share this case because it had several sort of unusual parts. One is the non-obese insulin dysregulation. We usually think those horses are fat, and most of them are, right? A small number of insulin dysregulation cases are the non-obese. They are skinny. So this horse, for example, we feed all alfalfa. Alfalfa is actually, it gets a bad rap, right? But it's actually, yes, it's high in calorie, but it's actually pretty low NSC. I mean, like 10 to 12%, somewhere around there. And so alfalfa is a great source for this skinny horse who wants to mobilize fats, who needs calories, but not a lot of sugar. And it really was sort of interesting to find what types of foods. Beet pulp was a good option for this horse. And trying to get him to eat fat, which was a little bit tricky. But so that the non-obese insulin dysregulation is one really curious piece. The way his body responded to the SGLT2 inhibitor, with clearly sort of needing time off in order to become sensitive to it again, that's a little bit different as well from most cases that I work with. I guess those two things, and they were all in the face of PPID. We did, just to circle back to that 1 second, we did increase his pergolide dose because clinically his phenotypical appearance was that of an incompletely controlled PPID case. And that certainly helped with hair coat and sweating, et cetera, despite his normal ACTH.
So how is he being maintained going forward? I know I've read some things about the SGLT inhibitors that it's not a permanent drug that you want to keep these horses on for life. Is that do you find that to be true?
What I find is most horses, you don't have to.
Right.
And that's what is super awesome. Most horses. So anytime I'm looking at cases or consulting on cases, our goal is 3 to 4 months on the drug. It's not always exactly that, but many, many times somewhere in that ballpark, maybe it's longer, not often a whole lot shorter. We can get them off of the drug. And the only way to find out is take them off and test their insulin.
Right.
There aren't perfect numbers to know, like, okay, for how long, if they have an elevated insulin, you know, how long are they safe before they have a laminitic event? We don't really know. How high can they be before they have a laminitic event? We don't really know. I mean, I sort of have some comfort zones, certainly in the area where I practice, but that's not a perfect science. So the only way to find out, like, is this horse ready to be off, is to take them off and retest. One thing that I will say that's probably pretty, everybody would probably know this, but exercise is a huge piece of it. Besides, you know, burning fat, it's has a remarkable effect on insulin. So oftentimes by the time we can get the horse exercising, then I'm like, okay, let's try stopping this and see what the insulin does.
Mm-hmm. So have you had much follow-up on this case? Do you know if the horse is still comfortable and doing well?
Yes, the horse is doing very well, is on his increased dosage of Pergolide. This horse, and it's a one-off. Is it one-off or two-off now? This particular horse, we cannot take off of the drug. The owner is aware that we don't know, and it's not ideal to have the horse on the drug long-term. And so we're able to be very frank. And when we try, the insulin shoots up and the horse gets painful again.
Yeah.
But it's certainly not the norm to have to do that.
Yeah. So do you have any advice for practitioners who might be faced with some of these more atypical cases like this?
I mean, the easy answer is call your favorite internist. And I hope you have one, because we actually really dig this stuff. I think beyond that, beyond call your favorite internist, I think work with the owner to understand that in order to help this horse, this is not a typical one. I'm going to need to do repeat blood work to figure this out. This isn't like come back in 3 months and figure it out. So right. Try to get your owner on board to allow for more blood work so you can figure it out.
Yeah. On a similar note, when would you typically recommend that veterinarians refer some of these trickier cases?
I guess I find that everybody's sort of interest level is very different in these cases, right? Mm-hmm. We all have different sort of areas that we dig. And I think really anytime they're like, you know what, I don't have time to like really dig in and figure this out, or I'm working on this and it simply does not make any sense really, or I thought I was, I'm not getting anywhere,
right?
You know, and we all have those cases. Geez, I have those cases all the time, and I have to phone a friend and be like, what is the deal here? Help me out.
I think you mentioned this at the very beginning, but do you think these types of atypical presentations are probably a bit more common than we think?
I wonder if they aren't, just because it seems like people are testing a lot more for insulin, right? There are stall side tests now that are actually like, you know, being valid, there's one validated and there's at least one more on its way. And the turnaround times at the labs that you ship to are much better. And so we're getting a lot more information. And so I suspect based on the types of consults I get to do with veterinarians that, they're not the one in a million.
Yeah. I just feel like these endocrine cases are just, there's so much still to learn about them.
I agree. Sure. I agree.
Well, thank you, Dr. Smith, for joining us today. That was a super interesting discussion. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
All right. And thanks for everyone for tuning in. We'll see you next time.